Well, thank you for the privilege of being able to meet with you and to share together as Christians. Now, you might ask, well, why are you here? You know, what basis do you have for being here? Well, in the providence of God, I have spent my working life teaching ancient history and ancient languages of the time around the Old Testament. So that gives me some basis, but not much basis, but some basis for talking about the time, the situation of the Old Testament. You'll see on the front of your bulletins, for any of you who read it, a little message that is making the very vital point that the Bible is situated in history. Real events situated in history. Now, one of the errors we run into today is people who want to say, oh, the Bible is just spiritual. It's a bit airy-fairy. It's that spiritual stuff. It's not really historical, not really rooted in ordinary life, ordinary history. Now, that's an error we have to avoid. But there is an error on the other side that you'll hear. Well, people will turn to the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, and they'll say, look, it just reflects the practices, the beliefs of the time. Isn't really relevant to us. It's just what people back there believed, and they were a bit ignorant. They're not like us. They're a bit ignorant. We don't take it really seriously. And it's basically that second era that I'm interested in addressing. Because there is a sense in which if you go back into the history of God's people, you go back into the time of the Old Testament that I'm particularly talking about, you go back into that time, well, there were things that were like other people were doing. They did have sheep and goats. But if I look at you and I look at how you're dressed, what you look like, could I tell you by your dress that you are necessarily different in your faith to the people around you? I suspect not. There are externals where we are similar to other people. And that's true all through the history of God's people. There will be ways in which we are similar. But there are also differences. And that's crucially what I want to talk about. But before I can launch into that, I have to set a scene. Because people will say, now back in the time of the Bible, so-and-so. How do we know what went on back in the time of the Bible, besides from the Bible? Well, you can learn a certain amount from unwritten monuments, you know, pictures, statues, but you can't learn all that much from things that are not written. Crucially, to understand the time of the Bible, we need writing. Okay? And you should be aware that in the time of the Old Testament, most societies were not writing. As far as we know, they weren't writing. Now, who knows, but if Aborigines were in Australia in the time of the Old Testament, they weren't writing. All right? Moreover, more than having writing, we have to be able to read that writing. Or some people will say decipher it because it's written in very different texts. If you look in the back of your bulletin, you've got something there. It's a picture taken from what's called the Rosetta Stone. And there you've got two forms of Egyptian writing, the hieroglyphic and the demotic. Well, we'd probably struggle a little reading that, wouldn't we? We've got to be able to decipher it. there was writing in the time of the Old Testament that we can't decipher. Nobody knows how to read it. There's no sure decipherment of the earliest writing from Pakistan or from Crete. There's other writing that we can interpret. Ah, but there's a problem. The writing is not from Israel. There is very little writing from Israel from the time of the Old Testament. Why? Didn't they write? Of course they wrote. But they wrote on things that are perishable. Now, if you got your newspaper and you dug a hole in the ground and you buried it, how much of it would be readable in 100 years, let alone 2,000, 3,000 years? Very little. Most of the writing of the time of the Bible is writing on perishable materials. So it's gone. That's what's happened to most of the writing from Palestine. It's gone. We've got a little bit, but not much. Therefore, we rely on, to try and give that background to the Old Testament, we rely on writing on materials that did not perish. And the major form of that, what leaves us the most evidence, is writing from Iraq, what in the context of the ancient world we call Mesopotamia. And there they wrote on clay, bits of mud. Now, what's the great advantage of clay for writing on? Well, it's easy to find. That's one advantage. But even more than that, what happens to clay if you bake it? We call baked clay bricks. And they endure. All of you probably have seen old bricks. You know, they're broken, they're shattered, but you can tell it's still a brick. So in ancient Iraq, they wrote on bricks. Even just baked in the sun, they survive. When people talk about background, historical background to the Old Testament, they're largely talking about not what we know from Palestine, not from what we know from where the Bible was written, but from what we know from over in Iraq. That should make us realize it may not necessarily fit. There are people, I think rather silly people, who go around saying, everybody in the old ancient world thought the same. That's simply not true. There are many different cultures. If you told a modern Frenchman that simply because his country is neighbouring to Germany, he thinks like a German, you'd probably get hit. We have a lot of knowledge of what goes on in ancient Iraq because they wrote on clay. That writing system was also used in other countries as well. We call the writing system cuneiform. Looks like chicken scratches. It's not easy to read. There are other ways of writing. What you've got on the back of your bulletins there is what we call Egyptian hieroglyphics. It's a different way of writing. But what makes Egypt different is largely they wrote on papyrus. It's a bit like our paper. Hence, a lot of it doesn't survive. We know a lot less about Egypt than we know about Mesopotamia because difference in writing. The little writing that we have that isn't the Bible from Palestine is written on what we call ostraca, broken bits of pot. You get a broken pot and you write a letter on it. Now, that will survive, whereas paper or wood or papyrus doesn't. But there isn't much of that. So what I'm going to talk to you about will largely be informed by what we know, which is largely from ancient Iraq. But I'll try and throw in a bit from other cultures like Egypt and other cultures that use cuneiform. Okay, that's background. Just be aware, this crucial point I'm making, that we often are making conclusions about the time of the Bible, not from right near where the Bible's written, but from other countries. Okay, I started off with that passage from Leviticus. Why did I start with Leviticus? Because it's a passage that you might look at and say, sacrifice. Nobody sacrifices today. That's old stuff. That's what everybody did. Well, yes and no. I'm going to say that often. Yes and no. Yes, sacrifice was common, but there's a crucial difference in the biblical approach to sacrifice. See, in most of the world around Israel is a world that worships multiple gods. And their idea of the relationship they have with the God is that the God needs them. He's powerful, but he needs them. What does he need? He needs food. In the Babylonian version of the flood story, after the flood is over, the gods surround the sacrifice like hungry flies. Because they didn't get fed during the flood. There were no sacrifices. The gods need us. There are people we call the Hittites. There are Hittites in Genesis, but we don't know whether these Hittites have any relation to them. But anyway, there are people called Hittites that lived in what is now central Turkey. And one of the Hittite kings prays to a god in the midst of a plague. People are dying. And his prayer to the God says to the God, now, if you keep killing us, there'll be nobody to feed you. The ancient world, you have this complex relationship of polytheism to its gods. They're powerful, often nasty, but they need us. They need us to feed them. They need us also to build their houses, what we call temples. God needs you. Now, think of what you find in the Bible. Is that what the Bible's saying? It's saying the reverse. It's saying you need God. You'll find people today who think God needs them to help him out. They are sadly mistaken. Whole biblical position is God does not need you. What's the Bible saying? It's saying God does things for man. Therefore, we should respond in thankfulness. Remember the story about how David decided he should build a temple for God. And the prophet Nathan said, yeah, sounds like a good idea. But what did God say? God said to David, no, that's not the way we do things. I will first build a house for you. Now there's a pun there. It's a play on the word house. I'll make a dynasty for you. Then, after I've done that, you can build a house, or your son will build the house for me. Always God acts first. You want to translate that into New Testament theology? We don't do things for God so that he thinks we're great and blesses us. God does things for us. God sent Christ for us. Therefore, we are to worship and serve him. God acts first. Crucial difference. Now, also, if you look at that passage that we read from Leviticus, you'll notice that there is some indication of why you're doing it. There's reference to making atonement, but there's no elaborate explanation. Why do you do this and that in this way? What you'll find in the ancient Near Eastern world is generally that is true with ritual texts. They don't explain why you do the ritual. The assumption seems to be that ritual works of itself. We don't have to know why it works. In the Bible, will you notice that we read from Leviticus? Where is Leviticus in terms of the Bible? It's in a book. It's in a book that has a historical context. Israel had been brought out of Egypt by God. Now God is telling them how they're to serve him. History and the ritual are combined together. You won't find that in the rest of the ancient Near East. You won't find a text that combines history and ritual, because their whole understanding of God does not involve history. Generally speaking, a crucial difference about the way the Bible speaks about God and the way pagans of the time speak about their gods is the God of the Bible is connected to a people. He goes and takes a people for himself. Even when they're out of the land of Palestine, God is with them. When they're in Egypt, when they're in Babylon, God is with them. The God of the pagans is a God of a location more than a God of a people. So there are texts that wrestle with the problem. If we have been forced out of this land, how can we worship the God we used to worship? The God is localized. He is not connected to a people. Yes, if you live in his territory, you better worship him. You better feed him or he will get you. But there isn't that same relationship to the people. See, characteristic of biblical religion is we are connected as a people to God, who has a personal connection to us. Just as God went to create a people, the people of Israel, so for every one of you who is a believer, God has come after you. God has come. God has found you. You have a history of connection to God. If you look back through your history, you will see that God is the one who comes and creates a people. Let me go on then. Well, wait a bit. Before I go on, I want to take a diversion. I want to wander off somewhere, because people say silly things and you read silly things in books, even from people who should know better. You will often find the statement, or I come across the statement, that people in the Bible times, including the Bible, had this very naive view of the universe. They had a three-story view of the universe. Heaven up there, earth here, underworld down there. Well, did they? Let me point out something very interesting. once again, we're talking about the pagan view. Pagan view. In Mesopotamia, you will find that they think of gods, as I say, as localized, sometimes localized in a particular part of the universe or the cosmos. There are gods who live up in heaven. There are gods who live in the underworld. But then you have a problem. If he's up in heaven or he's down there, how do you have contact with him? So they also say the god is in his temple. Right? That's why you've got an image of a god, a statue of the god. God's in his temple. But if he's up there or down there, how can he be in his temple? The way the Mesopotamians seem to solve it is this. They give the temple the same name as the area of the cosmos in which the god lives. They are saying the temple is the same as heaven or the underworld. Now, I'm taking you into a diversion. I'm going to confuse you, but I'm doing it deliberately. How can you have a simple view of the physical universe if you think this building here is up in heaven or down in the underworld? They're solving a theological problem. How do we have access to God? But they're solving it by the way they think about the universe. It's not simply three stories, heaven, earth, underworld. It's much more complicated. And if you will just simply read the myths, you have great difficulty working out how they are thinking about the physical universe. Because they've got to solve theological problems, not just physical problems. Anyway, that was to confuse you. Let me get on to something that's more practical. One of the things you will note in the Bible, as I said, is that the laws are within a historical context. God acted to bring Israel out of Egypt. He saved them. Then he gave them his law. It's the same structure you've got in the New Testament. Christ saves you. Then you have various instructions for how you live as a Christian. God first, you second. Okay. But often, we go back to Leviticus, often you don't have for an individual ritual an explanation of why you're doing it. There are a couple of cases in the Old Testament where you have an explanation, but largely you don't. For example, you may remember that there's a festival that the Jews were to celebrate, the Passover. Why do you celebrate the Passover? Because it's a reminder God brought you out of Egypt. There's also another festival, often referred to as booths or tabernacles, where Israel go and live in little cubbies. Why did they do that? It's a reminder of God brought them through the wilderness. There are those cases where a thing you do, a ritual, is connected to your history. But most of the rituals don't have that. So go back to the case I gave you and we read in Leviticus. What's it about? Why? Well, remember that the Old Testament is only half of the Bible. What's going to tell you why you sacrifice? The New Testament. Because it tells you that this is anticipation, getting you to understand what the sacrifice of Jesus means. The Bible is in this context of history. You look back, you remember God saved you, but it's also looking forward. You just won't find that in pagan religion. Because there's not the same relationship to a God who comes and establishes a relationship. Historically, saving, into the future, saving, carrying, keeping. If you look also in the Bible's lore, you will get that same sort of interest in history. Why are you interested in poor people? Why are you merciful? Now, our non-Christian society has taken up a lot of these concerns. Concerns for poor people, concerns for needy people. They won't acknowledge it, but basically it's part of the biblical heritage of our culture. Pagans don't have that same sort of concern. Why are you merciful? Because God had mercy to you. Why do you keep the Sabbath day? So that your servants may rest. That's the Deuteronomy version of the Sabbath commandment. Keep the Sabbath so your servants can rest. Why? Because you know what it is to be a slave. You know what it is to have to keep working, working, working. History, your own history, as well as the history of what God does, shapes the way you think. Same should be true of us as Christians, shouldn't it? What's your history? How has God worked with you? How has he shaped you? How has he been merciful to you? That in turn has to shape how we live. Now, people will say, yeah, the Old Testament is laws. The pagan people at the time had laws. Just the same. Well, if you go and look at the law codes from the pagan world around Israel, you'll see a number of interesting things. One of the things you'll see is that they are largely criminal or civil law. There isn't the sort of law that is aimed to make you a different person. You can't put that in law, ordinary law. Our criminal law doesn't have things that will make you kind and nice. May have things to stop you exceeding the speed limit, might have things to stop you killing someone, but you could do all of those things without really being nice. The biblical law is not just criminal and civil law in that sense. It is also a law aimed to make people different. Right? So it's the New Testament. It's aimed to make people different. Now, the closest equivalent we have to that isn't in the law of Mesopotamia. It's in the manuals that were used to teach scribes in ancient Egypt. We call them instructions. They, if I had to give a modern equivalent of these Egyptian manuals, it would be the modern texts that basically have, well, there's a famous one, How to Make Friends and Influence People. It's an older book, but there's a book like that. How you do things to advance yourself. How be nice to advance yourself. The Egyptian books of instructions basically say to officials, now, if you want to get on in your job, this is what you do. The Bible, there's nothing wrong with telling people that if you do stupid things, you'll lose your job. Nothing wrong with that. Proverbs and some of that. But that's really external. Biblical law is trying to go inside of you. It's trying to say, remember who you are and where you came from. Remember God has saved you. Remember he's brought you out of bondage and slavery. That transforms you if you really understand it. Finally, let me talk about Revelation. People will say, oh, all religions have their holy book. Nonsense. When people say this, they're basically thinking Bible and Quran. But Quran is post-biblical. It's modelled on the Bible in many ways. We don't have holy books from the ancient pagan world around Israel. You've got myths, you've got rituals, but you don't have a holy book that combines things. Also, you rarely have the religious texts as coming from God. It's very rare. The rituals, the things you do in temples, do not have, on the whole, I have to generalize, but I know of no temple ritual, and I know the Mesopotamian one's a lot better than the others, but I know of no temple ritual that says it comes from God. The rituals that will say they come from a god are what we would call medical texts. They're the closest thing we have from the ancient pagan world to medical texts. Pagan world says demons or ghosts cause illness. So you need a recipe for a ritual that'll get rid of a demon. Right? Some of those say they are authored by a god. Not all of them, but some of them do. The other thing that is quite common in the ancient world, particularly Mesopotamia, is what we call divination. Using signs to interpret the future. Some of those claim to be authored by a god, but not all of them. Now, the equivalent, some of them are the equivalent of, you know, if a black cat crosses your path, you're going to have bad luck. Some of them are the equivalent of that. Well, what do you do? Well, what they will do will also give you a ritual to reverse the effect. As I say, some of them come from God, but not, from a God, but not all. Very rarely are myths said to come from a god. It's quite rare. Why do we have many, many religious texts from the ancient pagan world that are not connected to a god? Because that's not the way you think about God. Prophecy is very rare. You know, people who stand up and say, God told me to tell you something, is very rare around Israel. And when it occurs, they generally say, we're not sure, we'll test this by some other method. Your relationship to God is not personal. He's there, he's powerful, he's nasty. You better do the right thing. There isn't that personal sense. Now, I want to conclude by putting something to you. If you go to the average man in the street and you ask him, talking today, go to the average man in the street, you ask him, what do you think about God? And average person will say, well, somebody had to make everything. Oh, there may be a God, but he's not particularly nice. The old Australian saying, someone up there doesn't like me. Ever heard that? When things go wrong, what do you say? Someone up there doesn't like me. He's not very nice. He's nasty. I think I'd better keep out of his way. Last thing I want to do is go to a church because God seems to be there. Can I suggest to you that the ancient world is not all that different to the modern world? Okay, they're doing something that's more obvious. They're feeding the God. But he's distant. He's unreliable. He's nasty. Babylonian flood story brings the flood because we're keeping him awake. You know, he's like one of those nasty old men where you can't have a party in the downstairs apartment because there's an old bloke lives upstairs who calls the police. That's their image of God. Is that your image of God? Who's there, sort of, but you can't trust him to be nice. Bible saying something very different about God. A God who establishes a personal relationship with people. God who comes and finds a people. A God who does things for people and therefore asks them to respond. Thank you.